Time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
Where too much networking would never be enough.
A podcast on the data networking industry. Routing, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Are you ready?
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and working in the networking industry. During the week, we've gathered articles and various ideas and now we're going to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench, diagnose the problems of the network world with humour, wit and maybe even some technical talent. And speaking of talent, our world-class pool of resources are here again this week to do the business. Jennifer, welcome back to the show. Good to hear you.
Hey, thanks.
Hey, what's been happening with you this week?
What's been happening? I've been trying to find time to actually sit together and put together that DIY mesh AP solution with that, I think it's called FryFunk software.
Oh, yes. We talked about that on the Unplugged show.
Yeah, I've got all the AP's firmware upgraded, but I haven't actually sat down to try and make them actually mesh. So I'm over the big hurdle of not bricking the Linksys that I bought, but... I haven't actually meshed them. That's what I've been up to.
Oh, that's cool. And also with us this week is Josh. How are you this week, Josh O'Brien?
Doing good, guys. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. What have you been doing this week? I see you've been tweeting about building a new data center, haven't you?
Yeah, I actually work with an insurance company here in my area, building out a brand new data center, and it's quite interesting to see what they have got done and what they don't have done about 3 weeks prior to going active. It's good stuff.
Okay. And of course, Ethan Banks is here this week. How are you, Ethan?
Hey, doing good. Looking forward to Tech Field Day and heading down to San Jose on Wednesday. So I've been working furiously at my job, trying to button up a few things before I get on a plane and head out for 3 days. And I'm cut off from the rest of the world while vendors fill my brain with all sorts of information, hopefully things I didn't know before.
Well, that's true. Well, maybe we should talk about Tech Field Day straight up, seeing as you've given us such a great lead in there. This week, Ethan, myself, and Jennifer will be over in San Jose. We're all flying in to meet up with some vendors who are going to tell us about stuff. And the Tech Field Day is going to be exciting from the point of view that we get to talk to vendors that, A, we wouldn't normally talk to. So, for example, we wouldn't normally have a discussion with HP or Juniper. Most of the time I would be able to reach out to my Cisco account manager and he'd tell me all about his Cisco stuff. But I think the most exciting part is when we get some of their best engineers in the sales space, you know, the top ones globally, come and talk to us about products and we can ask them really, well, we do ask really ugly questions. I mean, you've done the Boston Tech Field Day, Ethan. You've got a similar sort of view, have you?
Yeah, I actually did the Seattle one. And I do have a similar point of view in that we had access to people that typically get paid a lot of money to do their thing at a very deep, detailed engineering sort of level, and they don't have time for the little people like us. So you never talk to these guys. These are the guys that are right into the guts of the product, and either they're leading a software development team or they're leading a hardware engineering team designing ASICs to do for these products to do the things that they do. And so you're sitting there in the same room with these guys. And anything you need to ask or want to know, it's fair game because they know the answer. They're the ones, the buck stops with them as far as understanding what these products do, what they're intended to do. And then they're also looking for feedback from the community. They want to hear, well, hey, we took the product in this direction or we're thinking about taking it in this direction. And what do you guys think about that? You know, and then they get feedback back from the people that are around the table that implement this technology in our data centers every day. So it's really an unusual opportunity, a good opportunity. But another piece of it is the ability to, for those of us that tweet and blog and so on, we just get the feedback to anyone that cares to read what we have to say. They get to find out stuff that they didn't know about these products before and participate in that way. So it's a pretty cool deal.
Yeah, and it's also going to be great to meet up with you guys because, you know, you and Ethan, have been going backwards and forwards for a couple of years now, I think, on the blogger. You know, with our blogs and that, and I know Jennifer's been tweeting out with us, and I'm really looking forward to catching up with people who have similar interests to me. This is purely personal, and I don't really apologize for that. In that, I don't often get to mix with people like me.
Exactly.
Would you want to mix with people like you, though, Greg? Really?
On a regular basis, a little bit here and there is probably doable, but I don't know about being stuck next to the person in a cubicle for weeks on end.
That is good.
You never know.
And let me talk about disclosure. So, for example, I've put a disclosure on my blog, and that is that while our flights and our accommodation and so forth are all paid, and our meals are paid for while the event is on, we don't get paid any money, we don't get any recompense, we don't get any fees or anything like that. And the only thing that we actually get is maybe a free T-shirt or a free pen. Huzzah. So it is important to understand that there's nothing in it for us. And if we find something interesting in what the vendors are telling us, then we might actually, you know, we'll write about it or stuff. But in the same way that I write about stuff I've learned about working on Cisco equipment, I'll learn something here and I'm most likely to write something about that. So I think the disclosure is important. You know, we don't get paid. We are free to say what we'd like. And if you were actually in the event, you'd actually know that we asked the vendors some really ugly questions and give them a hard time.
Having not been to one of these things yet, I mean, just watching the information that came out of the HP one the other day, there's some really good stuff that's coming out of this that we're not getting a lot of market traction to and a lot of market information from until you guys are going out there and kind of exposing it. And it seems to me, at least, that the HP team, after you guys got out there and started putting stuff in the market, actually went above and beyond what they normally do and started putting more data out there to the people who hadn't attended. So I think there's some good intel stuff that comes out of this for the market in general.
Well, that's the win for the vendors. That's why the vendors are paying. It's for the opportunity to tell their story. And the vendors do have good stories. It's just a chance for us to actually hear what they have to say and decide whether it meets our expectations, and those vendors can come in and tell us something new. So,
well, it's less threatening than trying to call. Like, say you wanted to consider HP for your data center, and you call an HP 800 number, get routed through to some sales group, and the next thing you know, you've got some sales rep sitting across the table from you doing a presentation, and it's got that aura of, I'm not just here to learn about the product. I'm here to buy something, and they're going to want to sell me something. And there's all that pressure in the back of your mind because you're not sure what you want to do. Mm-hmm. In this setting, a tech field day setting, you can just sit as an engineer and take in all that technical information as it's presented and then come to your own conclusions without the pressure of a sales guy calling you up for the next 3 weeks. Hey, how are things going? Can we come back in? Can I answer any questions for you?
And when are you going to cut me a purchase order?
Yeah, but all those engineer types, we hate that stuff. We don't want that mm-hmm. stuff, you know? So it's good in that way.
I personally will be having a live blog on Ethereal Mind. There's a page there where I'll, if you've seen live blogs on other websites, I'll be posting stuff quite regularly while we're in session, taking photos and putting them up there. We also have Twitter, so those of people who have Twitter accounts, you'll be able to follow on a hashtag of #TechFieldDay, all one word, and you'll be able to see, if you follow that hashtag, you'll see all the tweets from all the people who are Twitterers at the event. And there's also an account, TechFieldDay, a Twitter account for at TechFieldDay. If you go to my blog or to the Gestalt IT blog, because the event is run by Gestalt IT, there's actually a list of the bloggers there and a list of the vendors. So we'll probably get those into the show notes so that you can go and find those web pages. Let's move on to something interesting. I noticed this week that Jeremy from Packet Life has managed to scrounge up another 3560s for his lab. For those of you who don't know, Jeremy runs a free community lab, which is available for people to access equipment to do practice configurations on, and he's been using the donations that you give to buy more equipment. So go over there and check that out. If only I lived in country, I'd ship him all of my old rubbish, but I don't.
What Jeremy's really doing there is giving back to the community in the form of that lab. So it's a nice thing that he's doing. And there was, I saw some comments about the second 3560 that Cisco at this point is having for the CCIE lab, for those folks that are trying to candidate for that certification, four 3560s in that lab. And you know, Jeremy's made the point, hey, it's a money thing. You know, these things cost money to get this equipment in the lab, even used. They're not inexpensive. And so he's talked about it'd be nice to build this thing up to a full CCIE lab profile, but he's going to need more donations to do that. So packetlife.net and check out the community lab that he's got there.
I think there's an interesting thing about this lab that people are either misunderstanding or some people are, and that's the fact that this lab is more of an NA, NP type lab on the front end, and that's the market it focuses at. If you look at those of us who are in market for a long time or starting our IE or even been going after IEs, we either you have huge Dynamip setups or me, I've got an entire rack of routers sitting behind me that I do a lot of this stuff on. The really cool thing about what Stretch is doing is he's giving the people who are just getting into this industry the chance to really get in there and play on real hardware, where the other opportunities are maybe the Bosun practice software, or if you are able to get a hold of the configs, maybe GNS G3 if you're or Dynamips if you're just getting into this. But I've gone and played in the lab and just started doing some stuff for some blog posts and some other entry level stuff. But for me, it's not really the point of this is a cert lab. This is the place where I can take interns at the jobs that I'm going into or young engineers and say, go here and really practice this. That way, when somebody starts asking you questions in interview or client sites, have you done this? They can say, yeah, legitimately, I've done this. I know that it's going to do this when I do this. And it gives them a chance to look what a real environment is. And Jeremy has done a really great job of setting this up to look exactly what it would look like to manage a small enterprise network from a remote point. All SSH or Telnet, got all the challenges of that. It's a really cool setup. And I think how Jeremy is expanding this is going to be a really interesting thing in the future too.
So people should join in, and if you've got the means to make a small donation, then you should do so. So I'd like to introduce our first sponsor to Packet Pushes, Escalta Training. Escalta Training is an award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner in the United States, which offers an array of advanced Cisco courses and addressing multiple technologies. Using Cisco authorized training material and with a strong customer focus, they provide top-notch training solutions and consistently highest customer satisfaction ratings. And not only do they do classroom training, they also do web and video conferencing training where they can deliver content to your premises and customize training using conference training or over the web and get that training to fit your environment. They are partners with Cisco for course development, and with well-known and industry experienced instructors, they can deliver public training courses and private on-site training. You can reach them on 1-800-297-4294 or find them on the web at escalta.com. They also have a blog at blog.escalta.com and on Twitter at escalta. If you follow them, they punch out technical content and special offers. I know that Brandon's been putting some good material out lately on the firewall on his security classes. And if you mention the Packet Pushes podcast when you book a class, you'll receive a $250 discount to get you started. That is Escalta Training, and they want you to learn something. Give them a call. We appreciate them for supporting the show. I notice also there's a guy, Stu Howlett, who has a blog at workingfrommyshed.co.uk, and he's been working on some Junos emulation stuff. For those of you who don't know, Juniper has an emulator called Olive, which allows you to run up the Junos software and play with it as a real system. I personally haven't had much to do with it, so be patient with me. But he's also talking about building up a lab along the same lines using the emulated platform. He made a comment on the post saying that he's getting something, and he's made a fairly long post on his website about how to build one of these Junos emulators and also how to do comparisons. You can also search on Junos and Olive in the way that you expect, and you would easily find people who tell you how to build emulators for Junos, for the Juniper routing.
Yeah, I think Stu actually built one of these out of a Nokia 330 firewall, right? That it was
he
an
did.
Older. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He did.
Yeah,
I'm looking at the website there, right now.
I mean, so that's an older firewall, but I don't know what he paid for it. How much did this cost me? £13, including shipping. So I mean, it cost him almost nothing to get a little box there. That's
about $20, $25.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, back on the day that we did our Nokia checkpoint rant that I was on, I said, I've got a Nokia box sitting here I haven't been able to do anything with. It happens to be a Nokia IP330, and I'm going to do this with it after I've seen this.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Now, if only they would come up with some way to simulate a wireless infrastructure, then I'd be golden. If only.
If only, yeah. You must have a room full of wireless stuff, really. Or do you borrow some of the
items? No, I don't.
You know?
Yeah, I borrowed. The place I'm in is just far too small for that. You couldn't get in the front door if I had that kind of stuff here at the house.
Well, speaking of all things wireless, there was a post on Network World this week that Cisco wireless controllers are open to attack. Maybe you should take that one, Jennifer.
Yeah, I see that they're open to all kinds of attacks. You know, these kind of DOS vulnerabilities have been present in other iterations of the WISM code through the years where if somebody sent the right type of form packet, it would basically make the wisdom reload. So I don't think this stuff is terribly new. I mean, it seems to be really convenient in pushing the customer base to basically upgrade to the latest code or to the next latest code version, since everything is vulnerable except for 7.0. Yeah. So it's kind of a nice way to shoehorn everybody into the latest and greatest, whether or not they want to.
Well, on the bright side, those of you who don't have maintenance contracts can get the latest version for free. If you ring,
oh, wow.
If
you, yeah, they are trying to shoehorn in.
Because what happens is if Cisco has a stated vulnerability like this and you don't have software maintenance, you can ring them up and say, I don't have software maintenance and I need to have the security vulnerability patched. And the TAC will release the firmware to you and you can upgrade effectively to the latest version to fix the security vulnerability.
Well, I did not know that. Because we've always had SmartNet wherever I've worked. But yeah, it seems like the vulnerabilities are valid. I don't know how often they're actually happening. I don't know. And just says like reloads and read-only privileges can modify device configuration. But the thing about the authenticated attacker with the read-only privilege that can change the configuration, I don't know if everybody knows this, but physical security is rule number one. If you have physical access to a controller, you could reboot it and console into it and erase it and set it back to factory default without even knowing a password right from the console. That right there, you know, when they say physical security, it's no joke, because all you have to do, it tells you what to type in. It doesn't even keep it hidden.
Mm.
So
it's pretty niche. I mean, if you've got to have an account, you've got to have a, you know, read only account, and then you can get an escalation and they're not rampagingly unobvious type vulnerabilities. It's not, the world's not about to end, but it is, you know, worthy of fixing. And there is a Cisco's website does have a patch on how to. The wireless kit does seem to have a lot of vulnerabilities, though, doesn't it? I think.
Yes, it does. Well, they're constantly evolving the code, so it's bound to happen.
For sure. Let's take a listener question here. This week, Tony Brown sent us an email asking. So first of all, he was very nice to us and said he wanted to say that we're doing a great job with the podcast, which is very polite of him. He said it's difficult. I love this. It's difficult finding other people who are sad enough to want to discuss these things. So listening to the podcast is the next best thing. that sounds, Ethan, exactly like the conversation you and I had when we first started. Really?
No, it's there's people that if when you find someone else that has the same interest and so on, and you realize what you're talking about, and you've just spent the last half an hour talking about configuring some routing protocol to do something unusual, and you realize that was a great conversation. There's hardly anyone in the world that has any idea what we just said. That is sad. I need to get help.
Anyway, so that's the purpose of the podcast. It's really just so we've could so we can have.
You're
a
not alone out there.
So he raises the question. He'd like to hear us debate whether you should buy a layer 2 or a layer 3 MPLS network. He works for a large global service provider, and recently we're receiving requests from customers who want to refresh their networks by connecting all of their global sites into a single VPLS instance. He says, personally, I consider VPLS to be more of a data center interconnect technology and would look to use it to complement a layer 3 MPLS global network. But the perception seems to be that layer 3 VPNs are old hat. So unless you have a good reason for not wanting to exchange routes with your service provider, I can see lots of downsides to VPLS, such as a mesh of routing adjacencies, global broadcasts, and small links flooded by broadcast traffic from larger links. Of course, there is hierarchical VPLS to help make it scale, but that doesn't fix all these issues. Just wondered what your thoughts are, and maybe one for Ivan. Well, yes, Ivan Pepniak would be the person, but you got us.
Well, here's what I have to say about it. I'm doing this whole data center interconnect thing for multiple clients right now, and I'm having some interesting conversations where in the past couple of years, everybody's been pushed to a layer 3 network, and that goes beyond just the data center. We've even designed networks where just big enterprises, we've done layer 3 to the core to the distribution and access layers with, say, 3560s and stuff like that. This all kind of plays in because we're seeing a migration back away from this layer 3 and into L2 technologies that just because these server vendors and VMware and storage and a lot of these other products that are out there, they're not layer 3 enabled today. So I think the same thing comes into application when you start looking at MPLS networks and you start looking at WAN interconnect. It's like, where do you decide to go because of where the technology is? And I think it's going to be different for every client and their size. I still tend to go towards the layer three for anything WAN interconnect for the whole broadcast reason and a lot of the other challenges that you get with segmented layer two networks, whether it's putting different MST regions in or if it's using hard BDPU breaks for spanning tree zones and stuff like that. But the point being, it's going to be different every time. I think it just comes down to what your application is.
I wonder if his perception is that people are asking for layer two because their layer three networks are largely static. I could imagine a situation where everybody's now got a layer three MPLS network and their WANs are all served over MPLS, or, you know, by and large. And so now what this new VPLS is actually sort of stable and, you know, we're all talking about it. It's just now you might be seeing it because people are actually using it. The second reason I'm a big fan of VPLS is because I don't trust service providers. I'm not a big fan of... I basically believe that service providers can't wipe their own bums without help, and they need all the help they can get. And trusting them to get an IP network with, you know, with routing to my network seems to be a guaranteed way to get yourself in trouble. I've seen several outages where the routing integration between their core and my core have gone foobar because they've made a mistake on their side. And that's not inside of my control. Whereas if I just had a straight layer two service across their network, then I would be able to use things like BFD and have end-to-end connectivity and know exactly what's happening. In a real sense...
Even then, though, there's no guarantee of that they're going to do it right just because it's layer two. I tweeted earlier this week asking if anyone had used Verizon Business's transparent LAN service. They basically hand you an Ethernet connection, and you can, that it's doing presumably Q&Q tunneling across their infrastructure, and you can build a VLAN trunk to somewhere on the other side of the city via fiber that that Verizon is handing you. And I said, well, how's the performance and how's the reliability been for that? And I got one significant response said, yeah, we use it and performance is good, but they keep screwing up spanning tree. And so we've had unexpected outages. Like, really? Really? Spanning tree? You're having spanning tree related outages? That really surprised me just from a standpoint of spanning tree is so mature. It's been around so long and the protections to keep the spanning tree topology stable are so well known. How do you screw that up? But then, you know, the last few outages I've had with a different carrier have been related to them disconnecting circuits. We didn't ask them to disconnect. I had to put a ticket in with my my provider about a particular internet circuit. Hey, this went down, hard down for 4 minutes and came back up, minimally impacting to us, but we'd kind of like to know what the heck happened. And the response came back, well, we were kind of cleaning up circuits and accidentally disconnected yours.
Nice.
Thanks. You know, so Greg, it just kind of goes to what you're saying. You expect the telcos to provide you this incredible level of service and have technical expertise that's way up there, but they're as prone to screw it up as any of the rest of us.
I guess the point is that once you've got an MPLS network, you lose all of the protections of a layer three protocol. So when we had layer two networks like Frame Relay 20 years ago, 10 years ago, you'd have end-to-end connectivity and you could use OSPF to see the end-to-end. But when you're announcing routes into an MPLS core, you lose all those, you know, features and you can't see the neighbors and you can't see what the far end's doing and you've got none of the technologies you need to show you what's going on because nobody's investing in network management. Don't get me started on that rant. You know, and then we've got bidirectional forwarding detection and we've got, you know, all these, you know, OER and PFR, all these great technologies that we can use if only we were connected at layer two. And I think what you're seeing now is a recognition that service providers couldn't organize a route in a brothel, and therefore we want to move to services where we're in full control of what's going on. And, you know, because the service providers are, I don't know what they're doing. Their networks are shocking, absolutely shocking. Reliability is through the floor. They can't tell you what's in their network. They've got no headcount to work out what they've got, or they can't produce a decent invoice that's actually accurate. Who trusts their service provider? Seriously.
Wow, that's true too. I trust them to have things not be working right. I mean, the thing about the invoice, it's funny, is one of the guys I work with started auditing our bill and found that we've been getting tagged for a DS3 circuit that we shouldn't have been to the tune of $9,000 a month for the past several months for a disconnected circuit. How long had that been going on? And he traced it back, and you know, now is dealing with the telco to try to sort that out. But that's commonplace. That's the norm. You expect it to be like that.
Yeah, you know, I'm expecting
not the other way around.
I expect my service provider to actually be accurate and to raise an invoice which makes coherent sense.
You hope for that. You don't expect that.
But I mean, every other business in the world, you know, like a cable company or a mobile phone company or, you know, anything else that you take a service from, you get a decent invoice in decent shape and you know exactly what's going on. When was the last time you spoke to your WAN bandwidth provider and looked at the invoice and said, yeah, I understand exactly what's on there? Because there's, you know, 35,000 different line items with line rentals and surcharges and burst bandwidths. And how the hell do you, you know, service providers lack so much professionalism. I mean, they are so disorganized and so dysfunctional and their business units don't talk to each other. I can't trust anything that they say. The fact that their networks work at all continue to astonish me every day because they clearly don't know. I can put in a request for a new service and it takes 3 weeks for my service provider to come back with an answer on how to change that service. And that's because everybody has to keep going. You know, they just have to go and research it and look at this and go through five different divisions to do that. And by the end of it, I'm going like, oh, I wish I'd never asked. And that's why I think layer two services, because you actually then get the control back into your own thing. You've got bandwidth going from point A to point B, and you can do what you like with it.
Well, I sent a tweet out to my followers and just said, hey, if you guys got any questions for Packet Pushers, because we're recording right now, send us some questions and we'll see if we can answer them live. Well, it's not really live because you're listening to this recorded, but, you know, that's the idea. See what we can do live. It's some real interaction. And one of the questions that came up here from Twitter handle Tab2, he throws a question out to Packet Pushers and says he's deploying 10 gig in the data center. What switches would you go for?
What I am deploying a lot of is Nexus 5000. There are some things I can't say because I'm a VAR and I'm NDA'd, but there's some things coming from Cisco that could be much more interesting than what I'm deploying right now. And then this is the part that's going to get me in trouble. Everything that I've been looking at lately for just straight layer two data center connectivity, which goes back to the whole, you know, storage and VM and everything else right now. If you just need raw connectivity, I would have to be looking at Arista networks very, very carefully from a price and port density and performance capability. I haven't had hands on one yet, but everything I'm hearing is amazing about those products. From a core perspective, when we're talking about 10 gig to core, I don't see another real play in market other than a 7K now. I know that there's some strong opinions on the podcast about the 7K and the Nexus platform, but that platform is pretty strong and pretty stable for straight up data center routing and data center L2 10 gig connectivity, especially with the layer two cards that have launched this last week.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that architecture. This card does layer two, this card does layer three, and packets go from here to there. But Ethan, have you got any views on that?
It comes down to familiarity for me, and it depends on what you're trying to do. If you're saying deploying 10 gig in the data center, I mean, there's a couple of things there. For what? How much non-blocking 10 gig do you really need? Are you just trying to uplink atop a rack switch? You've got, say, a 3560 or 3750 with a 10 gig uplink to feed a bunch of 1 gig servers there? Are you trying to uplink a blade center? And how much data do you expect to push through that 10 gig link? And if you've got 30 10 gig links in your data center, how much aggregate bandwidth do you expect to push there? And then if you're looking at the Cisco line, you could very comfortably get away with the 10 gig cards that go into a 6500. They are oversubscribed, and you know, there's bandwidth limitations there, but it's plugging a card into an architecture that you're familiar with probably and can go from there, as opposed to going down the Nexus line where you are really trying to design something that's going to scale up larger and go bigger. You know, outside of the Cisco stuff, I don't have enough familiarity to recommend anything for sure. My familiarity with Arista, which Josh brought up, it goes as far as the podcast that you did, Greg, a bit ago with Doug about that. And yeah, it sounds real interesting to hear about that. So again, it comes back to what are you trying to do with it? And there's different solutions depending on what you're really trying to do. Do you need something that scales forever is a different question from, hey, I need to uplink some top of rack switches. So
There's something that gets overlooked a lot in this discussion too, and that's the last generation of stuff that was moving into 10 gig from Cisco that's actually still a really strong platform. They had the 4900 series, which essentially was replaced by the 5000s and the FEXs, and the 4900M is actually a native 10 gig device using the X2 10 gig modules, and it also has 10 gig modular slots, or it has 1 gig fiber modular slots, or it has 1 gig copper modular slots. So it's a very flexible, small chassis for a much lower cost if you don't need a lot of the advanced capabilities in the data center, like heading towards OTV and VPC. But it also has a routing engine license you can buy for it. So for a micro core or just for a small size 10 gig aggregator, it works as a really good platform.
The 4900M, I've installed a couple of them. My only complaint about it is it is a big box for the port density you get. If I remember right, it comes with 8 fixed X2 ports, and then you can put two cards in it with eight ports apiece. Let's say you wanted to fill it up with all 10 gig. And that takes, correct me if I'm wrong, Jess, I think that, is that 4U, 3U or 4U?
I think it's 4U.
Yeah, I mean, so it is a big box, and if you wanted just 10 gig, you could get 24 ports of 10 gig out of it. So it's, but I totally agree with you on the functionality of it. And I also agree that it is overlooked. We chosen it for something because for the price point it came in at and what it could do, it was not a bad answer. Although in the back of our minds, we're thinking, geez, do we really want to be buying a Nexus switch instead? Is this 4900 the right way to go? And so on. But no, I totally agree with you, Josh. It is overlooked and it's a good box.
So for me, it would come down to a choice. I like the idea of Arista, but I wonder how much some companies could consider a smaller player like that. So because you guys have gone Cisco and Arista, I'm going to go somewhere else. My two choices would be either HP or Juniper. Juniper, because I think their switching products have got some real good ideas behind them. Their virtual chassis technology is very interesting. Significantly, even though it's a stackable, and we generally all hate stackables, and I agree 100% with that, their virtual chassis technology allows for very high stacking with very high performance, and you could get a lot of gigabit Ethernets into a single chassis. They also have a box called an ERX200, I think it is. I hope they're going to talk about it this week, which actually allows you to create a Cisco VPC idea of 8 chassis. So instead of having just 2 chassis bonded together to make one unit, they've taken it to another level and allow you to bond 8 7000 chassis style chassis into one coherent fabric, one control plane with 8 switching fabrics, which is an interesting way of approaching that problem. So you could actually have a situation where 500 600 10 gig ports would be one switch, one logical switch, redundant multiple chassis and all that, but still just one switch, which is an interesting idea. That's their big iron for their 8200 switches. If I wanted something a bit more down at the low end where I don't mind getting cheap and being cheap and maybe putting up with cheap, then I would probably look at HP, because they're going to be much cheaper than Cisco in terms of cost. They're going to be keen to do a deal right now. They want people who are going to take that kit out. And the A-series chassis from HP look pretty good. However, the risk here is you might be working with a technology that hasn't been proven. So how are you sort of seeing with that? So provided all you want to do is 10 gig and you're not looking for value-added services or too many fancy features like MPLS or VPLS or, you know, all these things that we talk about from time to time, for my money, it'd be Juniper or HP.
Jennifer, now you're pushing 10 gig up to your access points, right?
No, not yet. Not yet. But if you get a bunch of access points that have gigabit uplinks, you know, you may want to think about, you know, replacing your access and, you know, your switches that lead from the AP to the core. If you have a bunch of, you know, hard wireless users at the end, you could need to do that. But obviously you'd have to baseline your network and see what you're really pushing, because everybody wants the latest, greatest, fastest, you know, uplink, but it doesn't mean that you actually need it.
Yeah, it's the old story. Even gigabit to the desktop still overrated. We don't use anywhere near it. Most people could get by with 100 megs to the desktop. So, you know, that hasn't changed in the last 10 years. So Fernando Montenegro has tweeted in and said, how much internal firewalling are we seeing within data centers? Are people doing internal IPS or database firewalls much?
The environment I'm in right now and 2 other environments I'm looking in, they're not only looking at hard firewalls and zone-based firewalls between all their different segments, but they're also looking at bringing in F5 and WAFs, which has been another discussion we've had on here. I'm seeing a lot of segmentation in the current data centers I'm working on, which, good or bad, adds an incredible amount of complexity. In our labs alone that we're using to restage these things, we're seeing a lot of half-hour, 45-minute troubleshooting sessions just to find out it was a misconfig on a software layer or on another firewall someplace else that wasn't even part of the testing process. But we're seeing a lot of it starting to come up in the new segments, and I think that's being driven by PCI and I would say even non-standard but industry-wide type compliance within the industries themselves.
PCI in the sense that you need to be compliant with PCI, you need to be able to segment certain parts of your data center so that if you have a system that's housing credit card information and there's credit card data sitting there on that disk, even if it's just in transition, that it's being guarded by a firewall. Of course, there's also a presumption you've configured the firewall to actually protect the server in question, which is a whole other issue. But yeah.
And this, I think, too, we're seeing the rise of host-based firewalls. We talked last week about Cisco's Virtual Security Gateway, which we'll hear more about in the coming weeks, and VMware's vShield, which is actually putting application layer firewalls right on the server itself in the hypervisor, which is the logical extension of what sort of internal firewalling you want, because you need the firewall where the host is if the host is going to dynamically move around the data center. Ultimately, it's the rules that need to move, not the firewall. And that's the way the virtual firewalls work, is that you're actually just moving the rule base from this firewall to this firewall as it tracks the guest OS across the infrastructure. I don't think internal firewalling in data centers is as popular as the vendors would want you to believe, because it's not fast enough. In the core of the data center, you want a lot of high speed. So you mostly see firewalls being deployed at the edge in the distribution or the access layers if you have one, because having, you know, 10 gig, 20 gig, 30 gig firewalls is expensive, and they also cause reliability problems due to the fact that they tend to buff themselves up on a regular basis due to their complexity.
Yeah, let me throw a related question to you guys about that. Are you seeing more of these transparent firewalls, the layer 2 firewalls coming into play versus a layer 3 firewall when it's in that data center context? You know, the bump in the wire firewall.
I would like to say yes, but the answer to that is no. Security guys, I'm doing a lot of checkpoint work right now, and I Twittered a little bit about this last couple of weeks, and those guys don't want to do L2. It would have solved a lot of huge issues that we've been battling lately, but they're wanting to actually be part of the full routing context, and we're actually peering OSPF with. That's concerning to me for a lot of reasons, because the transparency would, one, help with some of the bandwidth issues, and also would help make these less technical. And, you know, the whole KISS concept, keep it simple, stupid, for managing and deploying and actually making more secure networks at the end of the day, because we understand them better.
You know, with the checkpoint boxes, you can go right up with a .1Q trunk and you could say, take a whole bunch of different segments, pump it into your checkpoint box, and then pump it out the other side, all as transparent layer 2, allowing you to handle several segments at once and pass it through that box and still maintain your adjacencies, your routing adjacencies through that firewall, as opposed to having to peer to the firewall, which I've heard a lot of firewall guys don't like to set up a routing protocol to their firewall because of security challenges that are inherent in doing such a thing.
It's a style thing. Different security people have different views. You know, one person will look at 802.1x, you know, so one of these so-called security experts will regard 802.1x as secure and the next one won't. The next guy will say, I like layer 2 firewalls because people don't know that they're there. You can't scan them or poll them. You can't attack them with a DDoS attack. Therefore, I prefer layer 2 everywhere. And then I'll turn around and then have another guy who says, I don't like layer 2 firewalls because they're not at the IP layer. They don't, you know, and then you run into problems where firewalls don't run very well at layer 2. There's a lot of software problems inside of the code with layer 2 firewalls too. I'm not sure if they've stabilized yet, but, you know, even running ASAs in layer 2 mode can be risky if you're trying to do it. There's lots of features that just don't work in layer 2 yet. The firmware hasn't gotten to a stable platform. The Juniper SRX firewalls don't have layer 2 support yet. That's coming in, you know, the SRX is a relatively new product, of course. So forth and so on. And of course, you get down to the spanning tree issue again, where if you want to build redundant layer 2 firewalls, you're going to be using spanning tree to achieve some of that, or often, you know, allowing layer 2 through. So security people now, are rarely consistent and all rarely make the same decision twice. So
the other part of his question was internal IPS, which, Greg, I know you have no great love for IPS in general. I would say I'm not seeing a huge amount of that. If it's IPS, it's closer to the edge. But then I've heard other guys say, no, we're putting it kind of like, you know, right in front of our web servers, you know, more deep in. I mean, Josh, are you seeing demand for internal IPS stuff, which I assume by internal they mean it's not coming from the internet, it's coming from a trusted or semi-trusted source?
We've been seeing a real mix of that, honestly, and that just doesn't come down to the three data centers I'm working on right now. When I was at the state a couple of years ago, before IPS was really big, but it was still just IDS and a lot of monitoring management, we were doing a lot of that in between segments. But again, when I say we're doing a lot of firewalling and IPS in these networks, I agree with Greg. In fact, a lot of it's happening at the edge, and the design is happening that is pushing these services to different edges. We have an MPLS edge. We have an edge that's dealing with PCI stuff. We have an edge that's dealing with this. And then there's these security zones that are being kind of thrown up at the edges. So it's all in the data center, but it's not huge bandwidth, huge transport networks between them that are having to deal with large, large quantities of data. And I'm seeing IPS done the exact same way. It's designed, these designs are working to get around either bandwidth limitations or to get around technology limitations with the firewalls and the IPSs right now.
The thing to remember is the more magic you put into your core, the more likely you are to break it. So if you start welding a firewall in the middle there and that firewall gets misconfigured, your whole data center melts down. Or if your IPS suddenly decides to go into intercept mode or, you know, whatever it is, it fails in the wrong way, your whole data center melts down. The only way to compartmentalize that failure and increase your uptime is to take complexity and put it where it needs to be. So if you're, I have several sort of mottos when I'm designing stuff that I sort of mutter to myself as I'm scribbling away as an ink-stained wretch as I write stuff. And one of them is that the design's not complete until everything's taken away. And that is exactly what I think you need to be thinking about. In the data center, you want to take away all the complexity from the core and put it all out in the edge. So you want to distribute your complexity and centralize simplicity in this particular case. Oh, did I go pithy and wise again or something? Sorry.
No, I think that's a pretty good wrap up of it. We can move on.
Okay. So probably the last topic for the show this week is that we've got two. We're going to go with two more. The first one is that BRIMCS from Twitter writes, do you use EIGRP or OSPF? We've talked about this a while back, didn't we, Ethan? One of the very early podcasts with Marco Milevicic.
Yeah. Well, we did. It came up in the mock interview show, yeah. The bottom line being there kind of isn't a right answer to that question. You know, I mean, he asked it specifically, do you use EIGRP instead of OSPF if you have that option? And I don't know that I'd put it that way. You know, like, oh gosh, I've got OSPF. I'm going to replace it with EIGRP. If I walked into a network with OSPF, I'd be very happy there. If I walk into a network with EIGRP, I'm probably pretty happy there. Maybe would need to consider something else for interoperability concerns.
Right the way and up until when you're working with checkpoint firewalls and you need to redistribute OSPF into EIGRP. Right, Josh?
I laugh because I'm doing it right now. Yeah, exactly. My take on this is there all doesn't have to be a single choice either. I tend to be, if I'm in a dedicated Cisco environment, especially if it's not an environment that has a huge networking resource, I tend to just go with EIGRP because my take on it over the years has been you have to break it. As long as you just follow the basic rules, the basic design guidelines, EIGRP works pretty good within a Cisco environment. OSPF seems to have a little bit more nuance to it, and ultimately I like the protocol better.
My view is that you should always choose OSPF. It's not a choice of whether you use either EIGRP or OSPF. You should use OSPF unless you can find a reason to go to EIGRP. In my mind, you would have to make a decision to go to EIGRP. Does that make sense?
You're one of these OSPF bigots because it's more of an industry standard kind of thing, and there's, generally speaking, there's some guaranteed interoperability.
Open is good, closed is not.
EIGRP's gotten better.
Because you'll always end up with a, if you do, you know, you implement EIGRP, you'll be you know, trying to integrate with an OSPF firewall or a main, you know, in my case, it's a mainframe that only runs OSPF. The only way they can get redundancy on the Ethernet interfaces is to run an OSPF routing protocol to loopbacks. So there I, you know,
doing the exact same thing.
It is a more of a commitment to implement and properly maintain an OSPF network. There's just more to it. You got to think through your areas. You got to think through what's going to happen when certain circuits go down and you have a convergence event. I was in a scenario once where I inherited a design that when a circuit would go down and ISDN would come up, just I won't get all the specifics, but the way it was set up, I had a whole lot of traffic that converged on this ISDN link that was really, really overwhelmed. And the network would come to a crawl. And at that point, I was not comfortable enough with OSPF to know why that was happening. And I brought in a consultant who I think he was a CCIE, and said, well, look, this is what's going on. And you've got a intra-area route that's going to be preferred. And so that circuit comes up and everything just converges on that because that's the way OSPF works. And the light went on and I figured out how to resolve the problem with his help. But that's just a case in point that, yes, OSPF is an open standard and so on, but there is more of a design commitment. And as Josh pointed out earlier, it's kind of hard to screw up EIGRP. If you get into a really large enterprise deployment with EIGRP with hundreds or maybe thousands of routers and have not done things like summarization and done stub routing appropriately, you can get into a lot of challenges with stuck and active routes if you have an unstable network, sure. But even so, within the proper EIGRP guidelines, if you pay attention to those fundamentals of a solid EIGRP design, it's safe. And you can do it to an ASA firewall. I found out the other day, ASA supports EIGRP now. What do you know about that? But if you're in a mixed environment, then right, OSPF is a safer bet for sure.
Yeah, I've just had it happen a few too many times for me to think that it. On the flip side, if you want to enforce a Cisco-only policy in your network, you can't go wrong with EIGRP to help make sure that the only routers you ever buy are Cisco ones. And certainly historically that was the case, is to use only EIGRP routers, and that forced your management to buy Cisco routers, which in the days when routing was very difficult and there was not training like there is today, was the only way to be sure that your network would actually stay running. We might as well broach the last topic for the show this week, which is to enter into the realms of religious debate about whether to use auto-negotiation on gigabit links, whether you should be hard-setting your gigabit or whether you should be using auto-negotiation. I personally insist on auto on everything. There are lots of reasons for this, but basically, if you go into the fundamental research around it, you'll realize that auto negotiation in the modern specification not only includes fast link pulses, which is actually used to detect and negotiate the capabilities of both ends, but in the case of 1000 base T, they also negotiate full duplex capacity as well as half duplex, and also the right for asymmetric pause operation. So if the one end can speak with pause frames and the other end can't speak pause frames, they will actually attempt to signal to each other to say, don't use pause, or yes, I'll use pause. And that there's a range of other things. They'll actually do, if auto negotiation is enabled, they'll actually run through some cable testing stuff. The fast link pulse actually does some cable testing stuff. And if you disable those features are lost. And if you have a failed cable, you may not necessarily have a failed link, and you get different sorts of errors even though it's auto-negged. Have you guys experienced that in any way? I mean, the old debate is that you have to hardwire it to know exactly what's going on.
I tweeted about this, and I asked the question to folks sometime last week or the week before, do you hard set or auto? And if you're still hard setting your gigabit ports, why are you doing that? Because I had one of the many interesting characteristics of the network that I've inherited is that the former guy insisted on hard setting everything to 1000 full. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why, what the reasoning was. And most everybody that responded back, I got a dozen or 15 responses or so, said, hey, we do auto. There's a couple of folks that said, well, we do 1000 full hard set because, you know, we're basically summarization. We're scared of duplex mismatches. That was the thing. because everybody's remembering back to the days of fast Ethernet, when a auto negotiation event would fail, you end up with 1,000 full on one side, 1,000 half on the other, or I'm sorry, 100 full on one side, 100 half on the other, and your performance is in the toilet. Greg, I can echo all the things you said about gigabit auto negotiation. Generally speaking, it just works. I have not run into but maybe a very rare issue where auto negotiation was a problem, such that auto is the standard that I like to run with on the switches that I'm dealing with. And as an exception to the rule, if for whatever reason auto negotiation is not working properly for a specific port and it isn't a cabling problem or whatever, fine, we'll make an exception for that one one port and hard set it.
My experience of auto neg failing is it's always down to bad cabling. A handmade patch lead or somebody's unwound too many pairs and auto negotiation. And that's why carriers experience auto neg problems more, because they're running the distances much further. They're running the fibers a lot harder and they're getting a lot more loss on the circuits and getting towards the parameters of the physical capabilities. And that's why they experience more failures. So by nailing it up, they're actually just hiding the fact that you're getting circuit packet loss on the circuit, frame loss. And you can't always see that until you actually analyze it. The failure of auto negotiation, in my view, is historical. There was a time when 3Com invented a full duplex standard, and then Cisco and Intel got one, and they weren't compatible. And so our default solution was to hardwire everything. But that was, you know, nearly 12 years ago, and in the standard has been ratified since, and all the manufacturers. I actually have a blog post which points you to various PDF documents. So Cisco, Dell, Sun, HP, so forth, all recommend, highly recommend, that best practice is to use auto negotiation on.
I was just going to say, there's only one time where I saw where I was doing a remote connection to a lab rack, a bridge link. It was connected to a port that was auto, and the web interface on the bridge AP was just ridiculously slow. When I set it to, you know, full 100 full, the web interface, you know, configuration GUI, it sped up considerably. It was very noticeable. And that, out of all of my time of working with switches and APs and stuff, that's the only time that I've seen an appreciable difference by hard setting something that should have been auto negotiated.
My experience, I grew up in that whole 100 environment, 10-100 environment, where you did nail up both sides because broken auto negotiation, and I was in huge environments. So if you didn't do it across the board, you saw, you know, big percentages broken. But in that same environment, we started doing the transition to gig, and this is going to be the really bad reason that I always auto negotiated gig. It's not all the technical reasons you guys have given, but the early gig NICs that we were seeing didn't have an option for anything other than auto. And as I started doing research, I started finding the things that you guys just, you know, talked about, which is a much better standard, much better implementation of it, and it just worked. And we didn't have those perspectives. Now, the only times I have seen auto negotiation issues in the subsequent, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, whatever, have been when it's been a driver issue. And on multiple occasions, on both Intel and Broadcom NICs, I have seen issues where we just weren't getting the performance. We were getting kind of flapping duplex type issues. And you go, you dig around, you find the newer or maybe even the older, in a couple cases, drivers. You fix that, and it ends up being a driver issue on how it's doing auto negotiation. But across the board, I do auto.
It's worth keeping in mind that setting things fixed also costs you money, in the same way that setting things to auto and having an outage costs you money, because every time you move something from this port to this port, if it's hardwired, you have to reset things. Your server guys have to configure their NICs to be 100 full or, you know, 1,000 base full, and they forget and they make mistakes. So all you're doing is moving the problem around. You're not necessarily solving the underlying issue.
Yeah, I've been in exactly that situation, Greg. Hey, this link won't come up. We don't know what's wrong. Look at the port, and someone had set it to 1,000 full, set it to auto, all of a sudden the server works. So yeah, exactly right. It's just kind of bites you in the rear end later on, a pretty good chance of it.
Yep. You sometimes solving a problem one way just moves the cost for solving that problem somewhere else. It's a bit like in a data center, if you put a big kick-ass switch in the middle, instead of putting a switch in the top of every rack, what you've actually just done is shifted the cost of the switch in the rack to the cabling, because now you're going to have to run a cable from everywhere in your data center to those big switches at the edge. And you're going to spend 10 times as much as you were on cables, because they're actually going to run all the way across the data center, tons of them. And that might be more expensive than the switches. All right, that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in about a week or so. So I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Jennifer, where are we going to see you? We're going to see you at TFD.
You are, and Monday I'm going to be on a roof in some school outside of Dallas installing a bridge link. So I'll be fully covered in sunscreen and sweating my butt off in the Texas heat Monday and Tuesday. And then I'll be on a plane Wednesday.
Yep. I look forward to seeing you when you fly in. We'll have a beer in the lobby, I imagine.
Yeah.
Or maybe even a glass of sparkling mineral water for me. And Josh, thanks for coming on the show at very short notice. And I'd like to thank Josh O'Brien for being on the show this week. You can find him at StaticNet on Twitter and at his blog, staticnet.com. He is often around, and he's a good guy to get a hold of. Ethan, what are you doing this week?
Hey, you know what I'm doing. I'll be on a plane Wednesday headed to San Jose. And, hey, I wanted to mention this. I was thinking about it. We're working on a show for deploying IPv6 in your enterprise, so get you connected to the Internet and then running IPv6 internally. If you are a listener to the show and you've done that, would you contact Packet Pushers? We would be interested in chatting with you, maybe getting your experience to include in the show, maybe even have you on the show. Anyway, you can follow me on packetattack.wordpress.com and on Twitter at EC Banks.
Thanks, Ethan. And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as etherealmind. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking about. And if you write in, we do use your questions on the show, absolutely, and we appreciate your feedback. Alternatively, check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave a comment on the blog post that goes with it, or follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at @packetpushers. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.